If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's the rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
Okay. That's clearing the voice for Aaron to know we're about to start recording. And we are back for another edition of Spirit of the Game. This is going to be so much fun. It's like you've gone off on a journey. I'm Ed Mate with a stranger. Who is this guy sitting across from me?
Yeah, Lewis Harry. Been a while since I've been on.
Yeah, I've had to beg and borrow to get guests. It's so much fun to have. It's like you've come back from combat. And now you're ready to, you know, the war front. The season is over. This is the November podcast. It's amazing to me how people start saying in August, oh, you must be about done, right? And you're not even close.
Yeah, it's the first real hump to get over in August, it always feels like. Usually yeah. Labor Day is
right.
The hump to get over.
Yeah. So let's go back. This is a season review episode. It's all about Lewis here. I'm just going to ask you some questions and we're going to see where the conversation takes us. But we're going to start at the beginning instead of, obviously, our minds tend to be where we are right now. And of course, you've already transitioned into the off season, I'm sure, mentally and starting to think about rules seminars, but we'll get to that. So let's go back to April and let's kick off the season. We don't have to go blow by blow with every single tournament. But let's kind of take these in chunks. So what stood out this spring? Obviously, when I think of spring tournaments, I think of snow. I think of all the challenges that come in Colorado with the very unpredictable spring weather.
Yeah, I don't really recall. I feel like we got very lucky with weather this year. I don't really recall a huge weather issue this spring. Again, the weather is always unpredictable. You don't know what you're going to get. You could get a 70-degree day. You could get a 40-degree day. But I don't recall any major weather issues other than the high winds at one U.S. Open qualifier. Actually, a U.S. Open qualifier and U.S. Women's Open qualifier. Same golf course within a week of each other. Both suspended due to high winds, played into the next day.
Yeah, because when I think of spring in Colorado tournament-wise, I think for us, I think about USGA, US Open qualifiers, US Women's Open qualifiers, because they have to be, they're so front loaded. And I know Kate Moore made a trip up to Wyoming. We took on the USGA responsibilities for the state of Wyoming this year. And I know that she had a very interesting drive to get up to wherever the qualifier was. So,
yeah. It's kind of, I don't really know my Wyoming geography, but it was in Riverton, Wyoming.
Yeah, pretty far north.
Yeah.
And I know I saw some pictures of it was quite a storm to get through.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's just kind of touch on anything that stood out. Let's stay with weather as a theme. Every year I think about how many evacuations did we have this year? That you were a part of where you had to evacuate the golf course. And was it how did it compare to years past?
Less than five. Like I said, I feel like we got a pretty good weather year this year compared to last year, where I think we had more last year, weather issues last year than we did this year. I think, yeah, me personally, I think I was only maybe a part of two or three evacuations, probably five total suspensions this year, I would guess. Two of which were very easy because we suspended play as the last group finished.
Yeah, match play was one, right?
Match play was suspended with the women's match on their 35th hole. Right. The men's match had already finished.
Yeah.
But that was an easy evacuation.
Yeah.
There was two players on the golf course.
I think you should have sounded the horn, like right there, right in their ears.
Well, the club siren did sound.
Oh, okay.
It did an incorrect signal, but it did sound.
Yeah.
We did a suspension at the ranch for U.S. senior amateur qualifying midsummer. But again, we suspended right as play finished. Really all we suspended for was the playoff.
Right.
There was no evacuation there because all the players were in carts. The one USGA qualifier where they do allow carts. So that was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
We also had an evacuation at the senior match play. But again, everyone's in carts, play suspended, 45-minute delay. We're back out there. Yeah. So
I was just thinking the theme here as we look at the season. Spring, you got snow and wind. Summer, you've got the monsoons and lightning and those evacuations. And then you get to fall. And when we get to fall, I start thinking about frost delays, the quote unquote leaf rule, which we don't play any such thing. That's sort of a misnomer, but I think about, you know, the fall conditions, aeration and the things that you deal with in the fall. And I also think of the fall as some of our busiest time of year. We're just running so many tournaments back to back to back. Cause we're a lot of times golf courses are, you know, it's tough for them to give up days, multiple days, consecutive days during the heart of the season. So we end up kind of moving into the elbow months. And the fall is a great time for golf in Colorado, right? Most places around the country.
Well, as we've also taken on more responsibility with high school golf and other things like that, it's backfilled the start in front of our season as well.
Yep. Okay. Now, let's have some fun with the rules. One of the things that I think, you know, we all know when it comes to people who are interested in the rules of golf and becoming a rules official. So I'll start with this. What would you say to a new interested rules official are the top three things that you deal with as a tournament administrator? But just answer that. What are the top three things that you feel like are the issues that you deal with all the time?
Well, if I was talking to a new official or someone interested in being an official, I would say the rules probably aren't even in the top three, unfortunately, for at least as duties, as you look at duties as a kind of this whole sphere as a tournament director or a tournament administrator, I'd say rules probably fall pretty far down on the list, unfortunately. You know, when you're doing those tournament director duties, there's so many other things going on with dealing with the host course, dealing with the host course's agronomy staff and setting up the golf course and making sure hole locations are correct and making sure the host course has all the information they need and cart signs and sending out pairings and making sure pairings are correct and, you know, communicating with players, withdraws, alternate lists. You know, all those things I think probably filter up to the top of the list more often than the rules themselves.
Yeah. That's really what I was expecting you to say. Cause I was kind of steering you there. Cause again, I think so many, newbies or people who are interested think you're going to be out there kind of like another referee in another sport where that's what you're doing. You're adjudicating constantly, whether it's a baseball umpire or a basketball ref. In golf, you know, you're really, and again, all those pace of play is certainly connected to the rules. There's rules tentacles from pace of play administration. So anyway, point is, it's kind of unique in that regard in that, you know, you really aren't, you spend all winter studying the rules and then you get out in the field and you're like, don't really need that.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say don't really need it. It just doesn't, you know, it's, you know, as all those other duties are piling up and all those other things are flying around the air at the start of a tournament, being in a tournament director's seat, you're just never really I wouldn't say never, but you're very rarely in that front and center role of being a referee.
Right.
Once play gets started and the tournament gets rolling and you get yourself out there on the golf course, then you kind of fall back into being a referee. But it's not first and foremost by any means.
Well, and particularly for you, I mean, you're the, you know, just like all of our tournament staff here, rules and comp staff you're everything. You're the admin, you're the course marking guy or gal, you're the, you know, liaison with the club, you're the weather person. You've got a ton of responsibilities. You know, it's really amazing. So should have said this at the get-go. I mean, what an amazing year. The CGA was founded to conduct state championships. We're very proud of the work we do out there, but that's all because of the team we have and the hard work you guys put in the early mornings, the late evenings, the grind. So you don't always hear thank you. So for the hundreds of people that now listen to Spirit of the Game, thank you on behalf of all of us. But so let's talk about the rules, though. Did anything stand out this year? I know that it wasn't the top of thing, but was there any notable rulings from the year that stood out?
Yeah, it's a good question. I felt like I missed so much of the year just because I was off playing referee on my own so many times. I missed the four ball. I missed the start of the match play. I missed our state amateur just because I was off doing my own refereeing. But
yeah, I want to come back. I want to come back to that because, think about that was kind of cool that you got to do some things, kind of some field trips, we'll call it.
Yeah. So we run this list throughout the season. Some tournament players might know this, some might not, but if you've ever WD'd, no showed, no carded, DNF'd, or got disqualified from a tournament, your name's on a list in our office. I don't know if, again, some players might know that, some players might now know that, but your name's on a list, by the way. If you're a multiple offender, your name's in red on that list. But after compiling that list, throughout the season, of all those things combined, withdraws, no shows, no cards, DNFs, WDs, DQs, we had 151 occurrences this season.
Wow. That's a lot more than I would have guessed.
And some of those, I think 30 something of were WDs.
Yeah. So
someone started round one, played round one, WD'd before round two.
Right.
Still goes down as a WD.
Yeah.
You didn't finish the tournament. Or, you play nine, you play seven holes, hurt your shoulder, don't make the turn. It goes down as a DNF. So things like that. It's not always, I wouldn't say not all 151 on the list are, we'll call it mischievous or in malcontent or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Some of them are. But of that 151, we had, I think, if I remember right, we had 9 disqualifications this year.
Okay.
And the majority of them were either, I think 3 of them were wrong ball related.
Mm-hmm.
Played a wrong ball, didn't correct. 2 of them, I think, were signed for a lower score or scorecard issue.
Mm-hmm.
Which people say, well, why is that still a DQ? We should just correct it, give them a penalty and correct it and move on. But it's not how it works.
Right.
We had 1 DQ for a conduct issue and then a couple other random, wrong place, whatever else. So it's just surprising to me that we, you either hear about, he got DQ'd for this, he got DQ'd for this. But out of, however many rounds we played this year, 3,000, 3,500 rounds played on the CGA this year, there's only 9 DQs.
Yeah.
Pretty low. Percentage. So
how many second balls were played in doubtful situations?
I don't have a list of that or a record of that, but probably quite a few. I mean, as many tournament players know, the procedure for playing a second ball is on the back of every printed scorecard. When we take rules calls over the phone, if it's something that it's hard to answer over the phone or it seems like a complicated situation, we always encourage a player to play a second ball if they're comfortable doing that. I know that sometimes players just play second balls on their own and then report it's scoring. So I would say quite a few.
Are the calls increasing? Because that's relatively new. It's not that new. It's probably been around now for at least a decade that we've been publishing the phone number of the tournament director and encouraging players to make a call. It was funny when cell phones first started becoming more common, the rules committee really struggled and every golf association discussed in great detail. What should our policy be about these? Should they be allowed? What's the penalty if they ring? I'm so happy that we now have just sort of settled in and people are, we still have the situation where you're in a funeral and somebody's phone starts playing a little upbeat jig or something. I mean, those embarrassing moments, but for the most part, tournament players are pretty good, but I'm just curious, have you seen an uptick in the usage of phone calls to you?
Possibly. I mean, it's also probably goes hand in hand that we require players to use their phone to do scoring already. So they already have their phone. or they have their phone available. A lot of the calls that we see, or at least I've got this year, it's not so much looking for a ruling. I think it's just looking for reassurance. You know, a player calling just to make sure, hey, you know, make sure I get relief for this, or make sure this is where I'm supposed to be dropping it.
Right.
I think a lot of it is just players calling and looking for reassurance that they're not about to do something wrong.
Right. So I was going to, that's exactly where I was curious to go is, so when you, when your phone rings, well, what's the most common, I was going to say, what do you, it probably depends on the site, but what's the most common question you get, do you think, when you see up, oh, here comes a phone call and you're already thinking, okay, it's probably this, or is it, random.
It's either one of three things in my head. It's either one, is this ground under repair?
Okay.
Because that seems to be the most common. Someone's in a bad lie and, you know, they're trying to looking to get out of it.
Okay. I'll let you finish the three and then I want to come back.
Yeah. Especially at the Colorado Open.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those players playing the Colorado Open try to get out of anything.
$100,000 to the winner. There you go.
Sure.
That'll motivate you. Yeah.
Sure. You know. Learn how to play have a divot.
Yeah.
That's all I would say.
Yeah.
Two would probably be, you know, penalty area relief, just looking where to drop, you know, blah, blah, blah. Three would be, and player, you know, this would take care of it for a 30-second read of our hard card for most players. But, you know, players, I still don't necessarily think they understand the 2-2 sprinkler head close to a putting green rule line of play relief with that. I think they know it exists and I think they are thinking, oh, I think I get relief from this, but I'm not sure if I do, but I don't know how to do it. I think players are aware of the local rule and aware that we use it. I don't think they fully understand how it works. So I think a lot of times a player gets into a situation where they have that interference with the sprinkler head in the, in their line of play next to a putting green. I think they're looking for the relief, that they are having an inkling that they're getting the relief. They're just not entirely sure what to do next.
Let me ask you a question about that, because it's one that I would love to get through my head. Is the way the rule written today on the 2-2, does it require that the ball be in a close Simone area? Does the rule require that, or is that still something the committee has to make very clear somehow by stating something on the model local rule or something?
It depends what version of the model local rule you're using.
Okay.
Because F-5.1 doesn't require a close Simone area. F-5.2 does.
So why?
And so we use the .2 version on our hard card.
Why? Sorry to be one of those guys. Why? I don't know. Why would, give me the rationale why you would not require it to be closely mown.
Just to give a committee flexibility if that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah. I've answered a lot of questions about this. And I know that part of the reason I asked you is it has changed. I mean, in terms of this local rule has changed a little. I mean, anyway, so that's good. So there's two model local rules you can use. One says it must be in closely mown. The other one says doesn't. So if you're in a really fluffy lie, and you're going to hit a big lob shot over the sprinkler heads, and you just maybe it's not a good lie. And you're like, you know, this ball's kind of sitting down. I don't like it. And oh, by the way, can I now move that into closely mown if it's within? Sure, right? I can go.
It's all part of the general area.
Yeah. So I just think that thing is
part of that too with the 5.1. Part of that local rule is that you could have a sprinkler head in a close Simone area within two club lengths of the putting green. You could have your ball within two club lengths of the sprinkler head, but it's barely just sitting up on like a tuft of, you know, at the top of the thicker cut of grass. It's at the very top of it, sitting up really nicely.
And you're going to putt it.
And it's not unreasonable for a player to putt that ball.
Yeah.
You know, with the F-5.2 version of that, they wouldn't be getting the relief.
Yeah.
When it's not unreasonable that they could putt the ball. And
so
like I said, the F-5.1 version where it doesn't require it, it just gives the committee flexibility if they wanted to ever think of that situation. The F-5.2, it just is a little more strict on what it requires.
So if you were on the rules committee with the USGA and you were debriefing, discussing changes, do you think both options should continue to be?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, it gives committees the option.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about your extracurricular work. TGA season was very busy, but then in the meantime, you got to go on some junkets. So let's start with the USGA events you worked, and tell us what those were and maybe a few things that stood out.
Yeah, well, one was originally planned, one was not. So I did two of them this year. I worked the U.S. Senior Women's Open at Fox Chapel in Pittsburgh. That one was originally planned. I was invited to that one, I think, right before the last year ended or whenever that invite came out. But that one was originally planned. A couple months later, I got an email inviting me to the U.S. Senior Amateur because they were short of help. And they just, you know, needed some help.
Where was that one?
That one was at the Honors Course outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So those are the two. That they were both in August. One was at the start of August. Senior Women's Open was overlapping our state amateur.
Yeah.
So for anyone that didn't see me at the state amateur, that's where I was.
Yeah. It's amazing. We did it without you.
It went great. It arguably could have gone better that way.
Never say that.
And then the senior amateur was at the end of August. And that one, actually, that one wasn't planned. It wasn't originally signed up for that one or wasn't originally invited, but I got invited because they needed some help. But that one was at the end of August where there was no conflicts and didn't miss anything.
What were you asked to do? At both championships?
So senior women's open, and for anyone who's unfamiliar with the way the USGA kind of does their assignments or does their, you know, referee stuff. So their open championships are a lot different than their amateur championships. Obviously with their amateur championships being 2 days of stroke play into match play, the assignments are much different than a 72 hole stroke play event. With the amateur championships, you need referees for the 2 days of stroke play, but then you need a match referee for each match going into match play. And sometimes you have more referees than needed. And then you have forward observers and rovers and all this stuff with their amateur championships. With their open championships being 72 holes of stroke play, for the most part, you're just assigned to a hole. You're a hole referee. And there's typically 20 referees on the committee, 18 holes. Sometimes there's a referee in the drive zone and a referee by the green on a hole if it's, kind of a complicated hole. But for the most part, you're a hole referee. So I went into the championship being assigned hole 11, 4, 13, and 7, I think, or so whatever it was.
Different hole every day.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Halfway through the morning on round one, I got pulled off hole 11, stuck in a golf car, and became a rover for the rest of the championship. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, a little bit different than I anticipated, actually was that ended up being really good because.
A lot more interesting.
Well, the hole 11 where I started the championship was a 138 yard par three with no penalty areas.
Good time for a nap.
Oh, yeah. It was just, the only thing I was doing to stay awake was getting flag times at that point. And the USGA staff was asking me if I felt comfortable hopping in a cart, being a rover. So I got pulled into being a rover remainder of the championship.
The first place my mind goes, if I were in your shoes, I'm like, ugh, I'm now going to be a pace of play guy. That's basically where I would have said, great, I'm going to be timing groups. I'm going to be talking to groups. I'm going to be, the ruling part of it would be fine. Mm-hmm. But is that what happened?
Yeah, for the most part, it becomes a pace of play, timing, all that, but for me, being at an open championship and, being able to do that, I think it's, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the senior women's open is typically for their open championships, the rovers at those championships are tour officials. For the US Open, they bring in PGA tour officials to be the rovers because those are the people most familiar with those players and have the rapport with those players to talk with them about their pace of play.
Right.
So it makes sense at a US Open, they're going to bring in a tour official to be the rover. At a women's open, they're bringing in an LPGA tour official. At the senior open, they're bringing in a champions tour official. There's not really a senior women's tour to speak of. So there's not really senior women's referees to bring in. So what's interesting about the senior women's open is that it's the USGA staff who's the rovers at that specific open. So it's just, it was fun jumping in that role with the USGA staff and being able to be a part of that specific side of the referee team.
So what did you learn?
I learned that Annika Sorenstam's group was easier to give a warning to than Joanne Carner's group.
Is it because of those players involved? Or
probably. It wasn't Annika in the least. Actually, I'll throw a shout out to one of Colorado. It was Jill McGill was the issue in that group.
Okay. She was the slow one.
She was the issue.
Yeah.
It didn't help that she made a quadruple bogey on the hole before I gave the warning out to him.
Ooh.
Annika took it very nicely. She said, thank you very much. We'll do our best. And then she kept walking. So,
yeah. Well, you got two champions there.
You do. That's a pretty good. Joe McGill won in 21. I think Annika won the second or third one.
Yeah.
This was the sixth senior women's open.
Yeah. Water bottle. What a unique tea gift for you. A water bottle. Never got one of those before. Sorry.
The water bottle is part of it. We have a nice little bag tag. Yeah, the USGA gives bag tags for all their players at each championship.
That's
with the championship logo. All the referees got a bag tag with their name on it.
Yeah. What did Joanne Carner have to say? I assume Big Mama was not happy.
She was just, this was also right when, this was like day two. She knew she was missing the cut.
Mm-hmm.
Her group was, I think, plus 17 or plus 18.
Uh-huh.
She's in a cart.
Uh-huh.
The others in her group are walking. And they're just kind of like, and you know, me, I'm just doing what I'm told to do over the radio.
Right.
But you know, this is round two. We've already had one weather delay. We're running out of daylight. They're on like hole 15. And it's just kind of like, the last thing we want to be doing right now is being talked to about our pace with four holes left in the championship or four holes left in their championship. So
you were like, Lewis, go talk to that group.
Yeah. No, it was like, hey, is anyone near hole 15? Uh-huh. And my zone, when I got pulled into being a rover, my zone happened to be holes 16, 17, 18, and 7.
Okay.
Just that side of the property. 15 green is not that far away from where I was stationed or where I was currently sitting in my cart.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm close. I guess I can go over there and grab them coming off 16T.
Yeah.
So it's just, I happen to be the lucky one that was the closest.
So did you find over the course of being a rover that your approach, style, bedside manner, rapport, changed, or you became a little bit more comfortable with it?
I've always been somewhat comfortable with it. I don't have any issue talking to players or letting them know that they're behind or this is a warning or you're going on the clock. Mm-hmm. I think it becomes a little more not antsy. We're not like nervous, but it becomes a little more, it's different than doing it at the CGA mid-am.
Mm-hmm.
Than doing it on a championship.
Well, that's where I was going. Yeah.
Than doing it on a championship that's being broadcasted on NBC.
Yeah. Sure.
Right. You're not that I was on TV.
Yeah.
Or God, I hope I wasn't. But you know, when you're talking to players like that at a USGA Open championship and you have, you know, the USGA on your chest and you have a credential around your neck, it just is a little different.
Right. So anything else from the roving at the Senior Women's Open? Who won anyway?
Letta Lindley.
Okay.
Now, other than me being a second and a half late with my horn during the second weather delay.
I'm sure you got some Motorola grief over that.
Yeah, no. I think maybe it was Ben Shade or maybe Bill McCarthy. They were...
had some fun.
Yeah, no, they were wondering who was late on the trigger there. And actually, I was quick on my feet to respond back that I guess my trigger finger was still in mountain time.
Could have been.
Which ended up turning into my nickname for the rest of the championship became mountain time.
Mountain time. Hey, where's mountain time? I like it. Way to stand out. That's good. All right. Then you got pulled in, as you said, sort of unexpectedly to the senior amateur.
Yeah.
In Chattanooga.
So maybe, I don't know, early in the year, Macy Wright, who's the championship manager for the senior amateur, she emailed me and said, hey, you know, Ty Riggin passed on your name. You thought you'd be a good addition to the rules committee. We need a couple more people to help out with the championship.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help out? And it's, you know, absolutely would love to. It actually ends up being a perfect spot in the calendar. There's no conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slower time for us. The only thing really going on here was it was the start of the BMW championship, but I really had no involvement with the BMW. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah, no, be great. Would love to. I only ended up staying through the two rounds of stroke play and the first round of match play. I didn't stay through the whole championship down in Tennessee. Whereas the senior women's open, I stayed through all four rounds,
right,
and worked the whole championship, but I only stayed through the first round of match play in Tennessee. Yeah. By that point, when you get down to the round of 32, round of 16, they typically have enough referees at that point to.
And what were you? What was your assignment?
For the two rounds of stroke play, we're zone officials, so we have a couple holes in a zone to take care of. You're kind of roving through that zone, but you know there's so many other referees on the golf course during that time. Where in my zone one day it was you know 1, 18, and 2, but if something happened on 17, I wasn't driving mm-hmm. you know a quarter mile over to 17 to go get that ruling. Right. But if it was something happening in my zone, or if I see it happening, you know, that was going to go do that. So I had two different zones, one on the front, one on the back during the two rounds of stroke play. And then I was a match referee for the first round of match play.
Anything come up in the match other than who's further from the hole?
My match was possibly the most boring match I've ever refereed. Both those players hit it really well, kept it in the fairway. We had two rulings in that match. We had one where it was a matter of if the ball was on the green or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the honors course, and if anyone's ever been to the honors course, you may maybe remember this, you may know this, but the way the putting greens and the surrounds are cut into each other, the edges of the putting greens are almost indistinguishable from the fringe or the mm-hmm. surrounds. And rather than putting dots everywhere on each putting green, as some committees do to define the putting green, what we did that week was we used the shade of grass to determine where the putting green was. So the darker shade of grass was the putting green. The lighter shade of grass was the general area.
Okay.
So, and it wasn't exactly always a clear cut line. Sometimes it was a squiggle. Sometimes it was a little splotchy. So it just became a matter of, is your ball resting on darker grass or lighter grass?
Mm-hmm.
If it's resting on darker grass, you're on the putting green.
Any part of it.
Any part of it. Yeah. If it's touching,
if it's 50-50.
If it's touching any part of that dark grass, we're going to consider it on the putting green.
Right.
If it's not touching any of that dark grass, and it's all in the lighter grass, then you're still in the general area. So that came up once. A player, he was just asking, because he was looking to lift the ball and clean, clean the ball.
Yeah.
And then another one was just a matter of a ball crossing over into a yellow penalty area.
Yeah.
Player, with yellow penalty area, his only option was either could have gone back to the tee or back on the line. Back on the line was going to put him on a cart path, or further back was going to put him in a red penalty area. So just, trying to figure that out. But other than that, my match ended on hole 15.
Yeah.
Pretty boring otherwise.
Yeah. Well, as they say sometimes about rules officiating, it's hours aboard. It's like being an airline pilot, hours aboard with a few moments of sheer terror.
Yeah.
Hopefully no pilots have to experience that. Okay. So then your other opportunity was with the Korn Ferry Tour.
Yeah. This was for the first one. This one was back in June. Kind of around the same time I got invited to Senior Women's Open.
How did that come about, by the way? Was that sort of through the USGA, or it's a completely different side of championship golf. You have the amateur side that the USGA oversees, and then we work through that side of the fence. But how did that come about?
So the contact I had for that, Jordan Harris, he's a chief referee on the Korn Ferry Tour. I had met him previously at IGA because they were, him and Ken Tackett were there doing a breakout session on refereeing. And I'd met Jordan there, and we introduced myself and we talked for a little bit. But then a couple months later, he had reached out and said someone from the USGA had passed on my name to him. I forgot who it might have been. Because also Daniela Lendl, who works on the Korn Ferry Tour,
as Yvonne Lendl's daughter.
Yeah. She used to work for the USGA.
Right. So she's on the Korn Ferry Tour now.
She's on the Korn Ferry Tour now.
Okay.
She was on the crew actually at the event I worked at.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyways, my name got passed along to him, reached out, asked if I'd be interested in coming out and doing a guest referee assignment. And we had exchanged some texts and emails back and forth. And then he asked me, you know, hey, we'd love to have you out. Here's four tournaments that are could possibly work. Mm-hmm. Let me know if one works for your schedule and we'll get you out here and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. One of those tournaments was actually the TPC Colorado event.
Right.
Which would have been great. No, hardly any travel required.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, it's TPC where that's in our own schedule. It's just a bad time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't going to work. Another one was in, I want to say Wichita, Kansas. And I really had no interest in going to Wichita. No offense to Wichita, Kansas. I really had no interest in going to Wichita, Kansas. And then another one was over. I had another conflict already. So then the one that ended up working was the BMW Charity Pro-Am in South Carolina.
Okay.
Which is an interesting one to go to in itself.
Does WGA run that one?
No.
Okay.
Because BMW is headquartered in Spartanburg.
Yeah.
At where the event's okay. at. I don't think the West.
Well, of course, you know that part of the world from your time in Philly. Yeah.
So the, an interesting one to go to just in general, because it's a two course event. It's a pro-am format. And you also have the courses are not particularly close to each other either. One's in Spartanburg. The other is in, somewhere, you know, half an hour away from Spartanburg.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I can't remember where Carolina Country Club was, but I worked the second golf course for the first 2 days and then worked the primary golf course on the weekend, which again, it's a pro-am format. So you have, you know, one pro, one amateur playing, but the pros still playing their own ball and half the amateurs just don't know when to pick it up. So the pace of play wise, very, very much of a heavy pace of play tournament for that one. Again, when being in a rover position on the Korn Ferry Tour, the size of crew we have, everyone's a rover,
right?
You're not just stuck on a hole or you're not in a zone. Everyone's kind of a rover. Yeah. You might be assigned either front nine or back nine, but everyone is kind of a rover at that point. And what was nice about being a guest referee for that is that they kind of bring you in and they treat you as just like you're like you're employed by the Korn Ferry Tour for that week. And you're just like any other referee. So it was a good experience and I really enjoyed it. Getting to know the people I was working with and those guys on the Korn Ferry and seeing what they do on a weekly basis, being in a, you know, obviously the players who are out on Korn Ferry week to week probably know those referees. So when they see someone like me, they,
right.
Who are you? Or
I need a second opinion.
When I'm coming in for a ruling, they're kind of, you know, a little unsure of who this person is.
Right.
Kevin Chappell did give me the, I need a second opinion, which I was happy to give him. And the second opinion didn't change my opinion or the ruling I gave, which
is
a little validating. So,
yeah.
But no, I enjoyed very much enjoyed the experience, liked doing it. It would be tough to do that 30 weeks a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be a tough.
Well, that's kind of where I was going as we put a bow on this part of our chat. And, as you look at back on the season, you really had the tale of three, jobs. You had the CGA, the work you obviously your day job, and then you had an opportunity to work USGA championships and both an open and an amateur. So really good. And you got to work a Korn Ferry event, not to mention the Colorado Open, having a little taste of the BMW, just shadowing a rules official. So you really got a pretty amazing year in terms of learning experiences. So what were the best parts of each? I mean, and I guess if you had to pick, I sure hope you say I want the CGA is the best because we don't want to lose you anytime soon. But what kind of stood out to you in terms of the culture, the approach, the ethos of each of those spheres of tournament admin?
Yeah, I think I'll kind of wrap the best part of it in kind of all together for all three, you know, USGA, Korn Ferry. The best part of it is that, you know, back to the beginning of our conversation, I'm not having to worry about pairings and alternate lists and, you know, printing this and cart sign, you know, that I don't really have to worry about. I just get out there and I just get to do the rules. Yeah. So that
obviously you don't have to drive up in a trailer and unload.
Supplies. No
tents, steaks. Yeah. Oh my gosh, TVs.
Yeah. No, I just get to drive in a rental car that the tour booked for me and then pooped out on me halfway through the week. Nice. So that was good. Different story. But story for another day.
Yeah.
So just being out there, and same thing with the USGA, when you're out there and you're just a referee. You just get to be doing the rules. It's a lot of fun. And I've kind of talked about, I think I've talked with a few people about this before. I enjoy doing refereeing a lot. Again, doing it 28 to 30 times a year as a full-time referee. I think that'd be tough. Mm-hmm. I don't know if my wife would particularly enjoy that lifestyle, especially, starting a family at some point doing all that. But being able to get invited to USGA events and going off and working, a couple of those, and being able to go to Korn Ferry. Very fortunate that, being able to have those opportunities and getting those invites. So hopefully be fortunate enough to continue to get those invites in the future and keep on doing it.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. You made a point about how the rules staff for a Korn Ferry event is much smaller than the rules staff for a USGA event. And of course, when you get into match play, it's a different animal, but do you feel like there is a need? Do you think that the USGA, if you were like building your own, and we'll keep match play out, you're building your own rules team for a 72 hole stroke play tournament. Do you have a sense of how many people, qualified people, and obviously that brings in quality over quantity. What are the pros and cons of their different styles?
Yeah, it's so just dependent on either event to event, course to course, because you look at Korn Ferry, like we had down there working the second golf course for that event. We had 7 people on that crew for that. And again, much less spectators at the second golf course, much less infrastructure, much less everything. When I was over at Carolina for the Korn Ferry, they don't have TV over there. They don't have trailers. We had 1 leaderboard and a couple other things on the golf course. And then when you flipped over to Thornblade, where the main golf course was, there's trailers everywhere. There's TV everywhere. There's leaderboards everywhere. There's hospitality. There's just fencing. And there's all this stuff. So it makes sense that, we only had 6 or 7 over at Carolina. But then you have another 12 over here at the main golf course for all that other stuff going on. Same thing with at Fox Chapel with the USGA, with the Senior Women's Open. Compared to a U.S. Open or even a U.S. Women's Open, we don't have the infrastructure. The Senior Women's Open's not roped green to tee. It's roped around the greens and the tees, but it's not roped green to tee. Mm-hmm. There's just much less things going on the golf course. And I think it lends to just much less need for having 40 people out there. Right. Now, I think for Senior Women's Open, I think we had 24 on the committee, including the USGA staff themselves and the actual committee. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, again, you have 18 hole referees, you have rovers on each side. You have someone, Ryan Farb had to leave the golf course because he had to go on broadcast and be the rules guy on broadcast. You have a chief referee that's, trying to manage all this. You have a pace of play administrator that's trying to manage that. So I think it's just different needs, different golf courses, but I will say that, compared to our CGA events, sometimes where it's just myself, a couple interns and maybe 1 volunteer, a little different of a challenge there than with 20 other people.
Yeah. So as we wrap up here, it's now November. And what's up? What's other than some well-deserved rest in R&R? What does the winter look like, and what are you going to be doing over the next couple months? People say, what do you do in the winter? What's your answer?
Plan for 2025. you know, all of us on the team are deep into site selection right now and trying to get sites and reaching out to people and trying to get some dates. And USGA wants us to get all of our qualifying sites by the end of the year. And that's always a tall task for us to do. And especially in Colorado with trying to get our own stuff solidified first before we do any USGA stuff. Cause you know, it's hard to place a 1 day qualifier when you still have a 5 day championship to place.
Right.
But yeah, just site selection, kind of shifting back into rules, education, rules studying mode. Signed up for my rules workshop today.
Where are you going?
San Diego.
Was there one in Denver?
No, not.
Okay.
I have not returned to Denver.
Yeah.
But San Diego in February.
That doesn't sound too bad.
It sounds a lot better than Ann Arbor, Michigan or Des Moines, Iowa. No offense to Ann Arbor, Michigan, Des Moines, Iowa.
Again, in the case of these seminars, it's less important where they are because you're not exactly going to be out gallivanting. It's more important who's the teacher and have you heard them before and is it an advanced workshop and those other things, right?
Yeah, for the most part, a lot of it now comes down to the date. Mm-hmm. You know, I never want to go to the first one because I don't want to cram my studying into a month and a half. I also don't want to go to the last one and have to be studying for 5.5 months and get bored with it.
Yeah.
As much as I love the rules, then studying for 5.5 months, you can kind of burn yourself out.
So you pace yourself.
So I kind of try to do it in the middle, kind of that end of February, start of March timeframe. Gives me enough time to do enough studying that I need to do and then it gives enough time to where as soon as I take the exam between there and the start of the season, it's enough time between those two timeframes to where I'm not pushing it right up to the start of the season.
Right.
So going to start getting back in the book, start studying for that. I don't necessarily need to take the exam again. Our scores are good for the 4 year cycle of the rules that are the score I've whenever the cycle started back in 23, that score is good until 27 when the new cycle starts. So I don't really need to take the exam.
Yeah, but we all know you're still seeking that magical.
It's just more of the chase for the hundreds.
Yeah. So where are you?
My last score is 98.
Okay. You're getting there.
So
you just got to work on those little, that one up and down on hole five, you got to, whatever it may have been. Maybe the pencil lead broke. I don't know. You misadded something. The guy next to you sneezed on your test paper and
well now I've started to take the exam at home on the computer in the comfort of my own home on my own computer with no other distractions, which has been nice.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Well, listen, thanks for an amazing year, fun chat, fun nice little look back on 2024, and here's to a great 2025.
Yeah,
thanks, Lewis.
You got it.